Bones, altra vegada. Anem a començar aquesta primera conferència que durarà previstes d'una hora i mitja. En principi, la primera hora farà l'exposició al professor i després tindrem mitja hora de diàleg entre les dues parts, no? Entre tots nosaltres, mal, justament per intentar aprofitar l'oportunitat de tenir-lo aquí entre nosaltres el dia d'avui. Si m'ho permeteu, canviaré l'idioma per presentar-me. Welcome to Girona, dear professor. Professor Cameron McCarthy is coming from the University of Illinois in the States. As many of you know, Urbana-Champaign is one of the best universities in the States, and so it's probably one of the best in the world too. It's in near Chicago, it must be, I think. It's not related to the symposium, it just came to my mind that, I don't know if you know it, probably not, that in this university we have... Is this on? Oh, yes. Ah, yeah, okay, yes. I think, okay, just came to my mind, just 1 minute, that in our university we have a professor that's a writer, a very famous writer. And he has now this year, it's called Javier Cercas. Now this year he has our literary Spanish award for the best, one of the best books. And one of his previous books was from a professor from the University of Girona that went to stay in to a postdoctoral stage at the University of Urbana. So, and all the book is located in Urbana, so many of the people who are here perhaps has read this book, that's called, I think it's, I don't know in English, it must be The Spirit of the Light or something like that. That we know something at least about your university. Well, Professor Cameron McCarthy has been a professor, visiting professor in many universities here in the States, even in Europe, and his research interests, they are focused on the race studies, and especially on the difference in the race on the education. But it's not basically analyzing alone which is the impact. If it's integrated with some of the main problems that we, or the main issues or the main dynamics of our world at this moment. Let's talk about neoliberalism, let's talk about globalization, and how the education, even the education in the schools, even the education in the universities, can improve and avoid these challenges, that's the difference between races, for instance. So please, we really appreciate that you can be here this morning. And thank you very much. It's your turn. Thank you very much.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm delighted and thrilled to be here. I have been making it a habit to come to Spain and to be in Barcelona almost once a year. I think this is an extraordinary context and an extraordinary time. And the emphases of the symposium on education, language, and immigration are very important issues as we look at the contemporary context. I'm going to turn this off because I'm not hearing translation as yet. As I was saying, it's an extraordinary time, how we make meaning of it is equally important. That is, we're looking at a time of incredible fiscal crises around the world. The United States is certainly marked by that dynamic, and it's a time also defined by particular policy approaches that we summarize in terms of neoliberalism, which I understand as a process of class redistribution, that is, redistribution of resources, often from public sources to private sources, and this is happening in education. And I want to argue that education is coming under a new identity, that it is coming under the logic of predatory hyper-capitalism, certainly in the United States, as capitalism seeks out new sources of value in immaterial resources. Education, the whole logic of information generation is therefore being redefined. And so one needs then to connect the developments in education to developments happening within development, within, broadly speaking, real estate, and developments within the city, within the projects of gentrification, etc., and to see the city, for example, as a powerful metaphor, a powerful mobilizing discourse for a new kind of spatialization in which the dynamics of race and class powerfully intersect. So I want to start off, if I may, with the first image. I hope I can do this, or somebody can help me with it. Of these are images of development taking place in India and all over the world, I would argue. Whether it's India, whether it's New York City, whether it's Chicago, whether it's Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, there are these new patterns of enclavism. Let's not worry, I'll just summarize. And what it does is to foreground some of the new incredible constructions in Bangalore, in Mumbai, in Calcutta, all over India, where you have this extraordinary smooth surface of architectural building. You could go to...
Just go ahead, sorry. I will.
You could go to Chicago and see the same thing. You could go to Buenos Aires and see the same thing. The point that I'm trying to make is that in all these settings, you have these there it is, finalmente.
Thank you.
Okay, that's a, well, what I'm trying to foreground here is this incredible smooth surface of enclave development, self-sustaining in many cases, where you have high-end restaurants, where you have great parks, where you have great schools for the professional middle class, etc. You can find these all over the world as capital invests in building, not for housing and residentiality, but for the process of further capital accumulation. The question is that we're dealing, I'm arguing, with a struggle over the iconography of the present. That is, how is the present to be understood? How is the present to be represented? Because what these, finally, what these smooth surfaces hide are forces of profound stratification. Forces of incredible inequality, and forces of powerful displacement. That is, the process of gentrification involves displacing, in the case of American cities, but if you were in Malaysia or Indonesia or elsewhere, it also involves displacement of minority populations. Often those populations move to satellite towns or cities in the outside the main city, in the suburbs, away from public transport, meaning that it's hard to get to jobs, hard to get to good education, etc. That's the story I'm partly wanting to talk about in my presentation today. And I wanted to go to some of these images that I had here. Let's see if I can find the third set. First to the way in which New York was understood by a black photographer, journalist, prior to the civil rights. Here are these images that we want to foreground. These are images of a photographer who passed away last year. He was 90 years old. His name was Roy de Carava. And he did these photographs of African American people living in the city, the black working class grounded in the city, living the meaningful life. Each of these subjects seemed to have and manifest a kind of humanism caught in the meaningful nature of everyday existence. Musicians, ordinary people living in the context of the city. And it is this kind of humanism that reflexive, thoughtful humanism that I want to see as what we begin to interpolate as our practice and our intervention within education. Above all, this presentation then, as an intervention in current debates over race, proceeds on the central working assumption the study of racial logics in the new century is not to be methodologically separated from a keen assessment of the entailment and imbrication of race in the new powerful dynamics associated with flexible capitalism, globalization, and neoliberal policy environment. I'm saying that globalization is literally throwing bodies of people up against each other. Whether you are in the north of England in Teesside, where the new populations come in as immigrants from the former colonies, from Pakistan, from India, from the Caribbean, etc. All of these populations of young people are living in the context of post-industrialization. This is a context of the working class without work, chronic unemployment. And in that context, I'm arguing, race is achieving a new likeness of being. That is, that race is being deployed by what I call unbenevolent authors who then can appropriate racial discourse and redirect it to particular interests. So that in the United States, for instance, one of the leading conservative radio talk show hosts, Glenn Beck, can call the president a racist. The black president of the United States. And that discourse can ride conversations about policy and the direction of the United States for some time. I'm talking about who can constitute their fears into public policy. That is the new environment in which we are operating. This approach effectively connects race to class. That is, when we talk about race, in my view, you always have to talk about race in the context of class developments and class stratification. In the understanding of the particular mobilization of the discourse of multiculture that has as its subject an ecumenical, cross-ethnic, cross-dressing, domestic and foreign, professional middle-class agent, the beneficiary of gentrification in the city and narrow utilitarian goals in the university. So I'm seeing the city then as a workable material metaphor that commands and calls resources, not simply as a walled settlement, settlement in which, as Richard Sennett in the Fall of Public Man, strangers meet, but also a metaphor about the university and education as a knowledge city, in which the university is attempting to understand globalization and the international student bodies as a way to resolve its fiscal crises in the United States. So you have a restructuring and reorganization of knowledge taking place with all kinds of implications for the nature of intellectual labor. We often think that what we do as academics and teachers is separate from the process of proletarianization and labor. And I want to argue, in fact, that our work involves and is intersected with some of the same processes and logics of neoliberalism that is affecting how our labor process is articulated and organized. The variable of race cannot be separated from the broad features of post-industrialization and the remaking of social relations and the renarration of social identities, which this implies. Further, racial dynamics cannot be specifically sliced off from the new policy environment that these new century developments have proffered. An environment defined by the predatory pursuit of new sources of immaterial value in culture and education and in the landscape of the popular. Neoliberalism and education in the globalizing city. So I'm saying the city is changing from an administrative and industrial capital to a global city. The part of its strategic logic, part of its strategic organization, is in fact a call on resources of financial capital, speculative capital, in relation to tourism, etc., and in relation to reimagining and re-spatializing the city, bringing new professional middle classes into that context, often on the backs of minority populations. So profound displacement is happening in the context of the kind of smooth surface of architectural display that we saw with respect to the New India YouTube postings. Neoliberalism for me is not simply, as others such as Masao Miyoshi has defined it, the universalization of the enterprise ethic. Instead, I regard neoliberalism as the great unmooring of things, of long-held social relations, the disembedding or ripping up of social bounds and social categories that we have used to apprehend modern life and modern institutions. Categories such as work, class, and race are now having their old contents emptied out and are being assigned new meanings that can evoke and call up contradictory moral resources and political purposes. I believe we are at a point in the new developments associated with capitalism, flexible capitalism, hyper-capitalism, that could be described as a new primitive or predatory stage, a time of the relentless search for new sources of value in ever new quarters of everyday life and immaterial reality. As Paul Willis notes in his essay, The Foot Soldiers of Modernity, late capitalism is not simply appropriating from nature, but is engaged in the excavation of human nature or the fomenting or raiding of desires, anxieties, fears, and needs for identity and affiliation in a world in which movement, restlessness, and ephemerality define existence and experience. Naomi Klein had noted this in her book, No Logo, in which she talks about capitalism's investment in immateriality, that is, in research and design and branding, and its divestment of the factory, its discarding of the factory, and inventory of products, devolving this task to export production zones in the third world, and the relentless race to the bottom. So much of this labor is going to Indonesia, to China, to Malaysia, etc., to deeply exploited classes of workers. So whenever we talk about race and class in the developed countries, we also have to think about the connections to groups of people within the third world context. But I'm talking about this in relation to the restructuring of capitalism, the movement from the concern with the production of things to an investment in stocks, the movement away from concern with production per se to speculative developments in capitalism as such. During the 1990s, says Naomi Klein in a book called The Shock Doctrine, many companies that had traditionally manufactured their own products and maintained large, stable workforces became known as the Nike model. Don't make any factories, produce your products through an intricate web of contractors and subcontractors, and pour your resources into design and marketing. Other companies opted for the alternative Bill Gates Microsoft model. Maintain a tight control center of shareholder employees who perform the company's core competency and outsource everything else to temps, from running the mailroom to writing code. Some call these companies that underwent these radical restructurings hollow corporations because they were mostly formed with little tangible content left over. So we're talking about organization of capital, very different from Fordism, in which the production is organized around workers who have a livable wage, to a new framework in which research design, a central core of elite symbolic analysts, and then the company disabuses itself, relieves itself of any commitment to its workers in terms of benefits, pensions, etc. You are seeing that transaction, certainly in the United States, happen with respect to education. This is the model of what is called in the United States the charter school, where public resources are redirected to private ends, and these ends become mobilized around a project of making schools commodified entities, elements of its administration handed over to private institutions called educational management organizations. Typically, teachers are not allowed to collectivize, that is, unions are undermined, and the participation, autonomous participation of parents is also suppressed. And in this space, the values or imperatives that are preferred or emphasized are values of parental choice. That is, if you have a bad school, you then could go to another one. And the long run of this is a sort of voucher plan. You give people money so that they can go to a private school or to make a different choice. So now cities and states compete globally to house what Naomi Klein is calling hollow shells, that is, corporations that have no obligation to anybody. New York City alone houses the headquarters of 44 of the top revenue earners on the 2009 Fortune 500 list. Capitalism's relentless accumulation process, this foraging for new value, for new areas of life, of the life world, to absorb within its grip, is articulated across a wide swath of post-industrial societies as knowledge, creative energies, and cultural archives come under the grip of new identities generated in the wake of commodification and capitalization. The logic of new capitalism, those logics are articulated to a broad range of developments which link the state and social institutional dynamics of class, race, and gender, in which education and schools, even as they become less of a guarantor of a tight nexus between schooling and work, that is, as schools become less predictable for kids' futures, education is becoming a crucial site for the playing out of these expanded predatory programs of new capitalism. Education stands squarely in the crosshairs of this turn in acquisitive capital towards the conquest of immaterial resources. So we're finding public school systems, school districts, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, etc., that are being run not by educators, but CEOs, chief executive officers recruited from business to manage this these school systems. And we might think that education somehow is value free. But the Chicago Public Schools is the second largest employer in the city. We're talking about a school system of 48,000 workers as a single employer. So this is enormous, over $4 or $5 billion in terms of its budget, etc. We're talking about a very serious economic outlay. Pauline Lippman and David Hirsch point to this these new developments in the city of Chicago, where in documents such as Metropolis 2020, Renaissance 2010, the Chicago Commercial Club lays out models of reform that reimagine Chicago as a global city in which a multicultural, multinational, middle class are the cultural brokers and consumers of new city spaces and services, education being a critical resource. As they say, Renaissance 2010 is this document. One would think as a document for education reform is coming from educators. No, this is a document that has been construed by the Chicago Commercial Club. The Chicago Commercial Club is an interest group of the leading commercial interests in Chicago going back to the 19th century, which sees the city as its playground for the articulation of its design. So documents like Metropolis 2020 are documents about how labor should be handled in the city, how construction in the city should be imagined, how we should address minority groups, and which makes central education as one of the things that it should foreground. So Renaissance 2010 involves the closing of 70 schools in Chicago and the construction of new schools called charter schools. These schools, as I said, are public-private institutions that are managed around neoliberal principles. The first thing you do is you get rid of teachers' unions, etc. And they're very committed to what we call in the United States high-stakes testing. That is testing towards basic kind of standards in a competitive way, and that is you get funding and resources based on your test scores. And so they argue Renaissance 2010, which is this document I'm talking about, is part of a larger project to raise low-income African-American communities with the goal of gentrifying areas with new condominiums, luxury apartments, and retail services. Renaissance 2010 reveals the increasing ability of corporations to reshape both the city and schools in their own interests using neoliberal education and economic policies to recreate Chicago as a global city central to financial, real estate, and service industries. Scholarly tendencies have emphasized or tended to characterize neoliberalism and globalization as a dramatic set of processes that explode out of the center of metropolitan countries, reinstating world peripheries into new forms of 21st century incorporation that follow the tracks of cultural and economic imperialism. I believe that we now need also to look more closely at how universalization of the enterprise ethic is working back within metropolitan countries themselves. That is, you have stratification within metropolitan countries that needs attention to. How these developments are impacting groups differentially located in metropolitan centers. How globalization is, in an uneven manner, throwing ethnic groups up against each other in real existing contexts and in the context of the imaginary universe of simulation producing the processes of electronic mediation and consumption. This is the world, for example, of the White Highlands of Teesside, Newcastle, in northeast England, in which white working class youth without work, this is a working class without work, in chronic unemployment. As Anoop Nayak argues in a book called Race, Place, and Globalization, collide with black immigrant youth from the colonies, from Pakistan, India, the Caribbean. This is the world of Shane Meadows' provocative film, This is England, about a group of skinheads who are trying to make sense of the post-industrial world, if I can get to this image here. I'll show you a bit of it. But in this film, This is England, this group of young skinheads, chronically unemployed. Here they're dressed in the uniforms of the other. And you're going to see what they're going to do in a short while.
Where are you going?
Okay, you get the point. Dressed in the uniform of the other, they set about destroying the apartment of an immigrant. The point being that, as many urban sociologists have been talking about, you have the emergence of what they are calling revanchism, that is, the notion of an intense sense of resentment on the part of white middle classes in the United States and elsewhere, and white working classes, that begin to blame their problems on the immigrant. And so later in this film, there's an incredible speech by one of the skinhead leaders, a guy called Combo, about the threat of immigrants to England and the need for policies that would stanch or stop immigration as a solution, so that the unemployment that's been generated by the restructuring of capitalism then gets blamed on the minority poor. So you have chronic unemployment, constrained futures for working class youth. This is also the world then of Southside Chicago, the property of Robert Taylor Holmes. The Robert Taylor Holmes was the largest housing project for working class and minority poor in the United States, in Chicago. But this project happened to be very close to Michigan Lake. It now happened to be close to areas that are now being considered as priority spaces under the new initiatives of the city in its redesign as a global city. So, if you go to YouTube, where all things are present, you can see this housing project being razed and demolished. And in its place is a new housing development. I'll just show you a bit of it. That's Robert Taylor Holmes Housing Project being destroyed. It's being replaced by a new multi-purpose housing development called Legends of the South. Legends of the South invokes a particular aspect of Chicago's history related to the immigration, the migration of black people, African-American people from the South to the North at the turn of the 19th century. And in this context, they created what is called a black metropolis, denied services and opportunities by racism in the city. They constructed their own institutions and their own cultural sites. All the great jazz musicians would have played there. Nat King Cole, Duke Ellington, Mahalia Jackson, etc. Well, the housing project called Legends South, which has displaced the Robert Taylor Holmes housing project, where thousands of African American poor dwelled, now quotes that history in its organization. And let me get you to their website. You can now buy a condominium in the Nat King Cole section of this new housing project. You can buy one in the Jackson section of it. This is Legends South. So you have Coleman Place. You can go in, click on this. And this is what you see. This is what is available to you. Now, this is how the website quotes the past. So what I started off saying is that we're living in a context in which racial dynamics are light enough to be skimmed off the surface of reality and put into new semiotic context, reorganized, just as Tommy Hilfiger, the clothing designer, lifted off ideas of urban style from the urban cool of black youth in the United States and incorporated that into baggy clothing and particular new style of clothing to sell to an ecumenical group of cross-ethnic cross-dressers. So you get the appropriation of the cultural form integrated into a new commodified item and sold back to the inner city itself, as well as broad youth consumers throughout the world. I am saying, with respect to Legends South, this new housing development, which displaced the Robert Taylor Holmes housing project, in which the former residents of that housing project now don't have the money to pay for this new housing project, for an apartment here. They're displaced by this dynamic. Legends South, paradoxically, ironically, quotes the historical past of Brownsville, the black metropolis that grounded Robert Taylor Holmes as part of the multiculture of Legends South. And so it refers to Brownsville and its past in this on its website, invoking its cultural history, etc. All of this is occurring in a city that is privileging particular dynamics in its organization and structure, where public resources are constantly being reabsorbed and redirected to private ends, to the ends of tourism, to the ends of attracting professional middle class. Let me show you another element of this design feature, if you can see it, in the way in which the Chicago train system is organized. Let me see if I can find the map. This may help me if I can only get to it. But what we see, I'll try one more time. What we see with this map organization, here we go, is the way in which the concentration of lines, if you've been to Chicago, encircle the loop area where you have, look at how this map, let me see if we can get a larger view of it. If you look at the map, you can see that central section there. That is where the Magnificent Mile is. That is where all the great museums exist. That is where the great sculpture park called Millennium Park is. That is where the Chicago Institute is. So you get from the airport by the train, you get into the center of the city, and this is a thick enlacing of lines and options for the tourists. As you move out, you can see the thinning out of these lines for the use of, so public resources, this is my point, this is public infrastructure. You find again and again, whether it's the Legends of the South project, where the developer gets the land lease for free, or the organization and coordination of public transportation, where public resources are put into the transportation system, directing it to the access of tourists and the professional middle class. You know, this is where the central ring of the city, urban dwelling, etc., enormous condominiums and apartments are being established. This restructuring of the city then is coordinated almost like a symphony in terms of its particular elements. You could see this as well in the Caribbean. Let me see if I can get out of here. How do I do it? Let me see. There we go. Because I want to say that these problems are not in one place. Capitalism, as Emmanuel Wallerstein points out from the very beginning, is a global project. It exceeds the constraints of state logics. And now, in the context of neoliberalism, the state is very integrally involved in its coordination. and that the state is profoundly invested in the exercise of enabling accumulation over and against legitimation. That is, it is divesting in the welfare of the people, in the case of the United States, in healthcare, etc., more interested in providing the market conditions for capital to flourish, and at the other end of that project, providing security and surveillance of unwanted populations in these particular spaces. So let me go to Barbados as part of this nexus of connections that I'm trying to make, in which again you see land being appropriated by capital for particular process, purposes, housing and development taking place that has less to do with residentiality, that is people living in a house, and more to do with generating and maximizing enormous speculative power, providing collateral, providing housing that if you own it, you would hardly live in it, but you have it farmed out for rent or for buying. In fact, some of these projects involve, you can own the place, you can also use it when you want to have your vacation in Barbados, you can rent it out, etc. Now these are properties, two bedrooms and the like, going for between $2 million and $13 million. You ask yourself, who on the island of Barbados can afford these properties? And this is what we're looking at. Properties constructed in ways in which nature is commodified, almost narrated as the place just for you. The sea and the water come up to you and kind of wash around your property as though it was your personal lake. And here are examples of what you have available to you if you have $2 million, and ultimately the sign of labor in a largely African populated context. But we could go on and on and show examples of this kind that I've been trying to call attention to. This project, in the context of Chicago and elsewhere, then involves pushing minority populations out to what are called by Gene Anion stress suburbs. Suburbs at risk. Satellite towns where people are permanently in limbo, where they're separated from public transportation, etc. New dynamics go on with respect to schooling, where these new populations come in to rural suburban towns, and then you get white populations moving out and constructing new enclaves, etc. So I'm arguing then the city might be a most pivotal place to capture these dynamics. Chicago describes itself in the following way in some of its public relations. It sees itself as a place that has these new accolades. And I'm quoting directly from the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. Quote, from its delectable dining to its family-friendly attractions, Chicago has received numerous awards praising the city as a great travel destination. Since 2003, Chicago has received such titles and awards as City of the Year, one of the top 10 cities in the world. It lost out to Rio with respect to with respect to hosting the Olympics, but you can see that's the design. This is Lonely Planet. Chicago is ranked the number one U.S. destination for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual business travel by the Community Marketing Incorporated of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual Travel Tourism Study. It's the city, one of the three U.S. cities in which the population says, we don't know which part of the population, but it says it's the most satisfied overall. It's regarded, voted North America's City of the Future by the Financial Times publication Foreign Direct Investment. Chicago is seen as the city with the most five-star restaurants in the country, including New York City. These are all recent developments, by the way, as the city constructs itself in relation to the model laid out by the commercial club. And finally, and this is one of my favorites, Chicago is the most dog-friendly city to visit in North America by dogfriendly.com. So you can see the construal of the city. This is then a context very similar to the way in which the struggle over iconography was taking place in Second Empire France as in the 19th century, in the 1850s, when Paris is emerging as a modern city under Louis Napoleon III, in which the cartoonists like Honoré Daumier or the writers like Balzac, Honoré Balzac in The Human Comedy was foregrounding, they were foregrounding the people who were deracinated, deracinated from agricultural areas, from peasant life, to dwell in the urban city context. And there's this incredible cartoon by Daumier in which you see these peasant people in a car of a train, and the train stops, and by inertia they are thrown back, and you see the fear and the uncertainty in their faces. So Chicago then is now a city where one can hitch a ride to the rollicking and rambunctious future. A new energy is being generated in the city that results in these powerful underlying logics of displacement, of class redistribution, as David Harvey calls it, of accumulation by dispossession. That's the logic that David Harvey uses to describe these new developments around neoliberalism. How much time do I have?
Not much. 5 minutes.
Okay, that's enough. I painted a picture of the city in terms of a new organizing geography. I wanted to get to the notion of the city as the knowledge city, the university, as it begins to interpolate and understand strategically globalization. And so you have these documents generated in which the universities, like the University of Illinois at Chicago, is developing its strategic plan for dealing with and addressing globalization. And it addresses globalization as a form of multiculture. Here's the University of Illinois strategic plan. The United States, says this document, is expected to be the major net receiver of international migrants, with projections estimating 1.1 million immigrants annually from 2005 to 2050. It is also projected that the Caucasian population, that is the white population, will drop to around 50% by 2050 in the United States. America, says the document, is becoming much more global and diverse. And then it goes on to say, we must prepare for this, and so forth. What I'm arguing is that for these universities, where the state has been divesting, that is, economic support for the university has been taken away within the model of neoliberalism, the university has chosen the option to hyper-privatize, to link education to a partnership with business. And one of the ways that it's sought to resolve this problem is in the acquiring and recruiting international student populations, particularly in Asia, India, China, etc. India's educated middle class is larger than the entire population of the United States. So you see where this is going. The international student population as a business is over $100 billion. United States has over $16 billion of it. Australia has over $16 billion. And some people argue that Australia sought to resolve its economic crises in the 1990s by strategically engaging with developing and recruiting and expanding its international student population. Previous to the 1990s, Australia actually subsidized its international students. They decided in the context of budgetary crisis to make the international students pay, and pay more than their domestic students. And this has been important in resolving budgetary problems for the country. The thing that the United States has to look into for the future is that in Asia, in Singapore and elsewhere, they're onto the same plan, building institutions that will foreground knowledge and information and attract international students to Singapore. I want to argue then, as a final point, that there are three logics, neoliberal logics, working through the university context that have profound implications for racial class inequality. The first one is virtualization. That is our desire for information craving, for speed, for the paperless world. In this logic, the university administration has constructed a superhighway with a one-way direction, that is, passing edicts down to the plebs below, but not a two-way street in which you have an electronic democratic community for conversation, particularly over issues of diversity and difference. There is nothing in the technology that obviates or prevents this from happening. This is a strategic choice of how to deploy virtualization. But it is driven by the imperatives of notions of efficiency, etc., that now mark the knowledge environment. A second logic is what I'm calling vocationalization. The idea that there must be derivable returns from education. That education must be directly linked to professionalization. This is coming at the cost of a vigorous investment and revivification of the humanities. In other words, paradoxically, it is those programs that embody critical discourses that historically in philosophy, in literature, etc., challenge the excesses of modernization. It is precisely those programs that are now under threat within this new educational model, which means that programs such as ethnic studies programs, African American studies, etc., now are underserved by funding. And finally, the third logic is what I call fiscalization or the bottom line. Each department now, whether it's literature or philosophy, has to break, as we say, break even, be in the black rather than in the red. So departments like philosophy or literature, etc., which are not fundamentally about venture capital, are being forced to come up with research programs and adopt management policies that allow them to be self-sustaining. Again, the choices are being made away from the support of critical programs related to ethnic studies, etc., within this logic. And so overall, as a final point, the humanistic imperatives, the imperatives that I call attention at the beginning of this talk related to Roy de Cabra's photography, in which he is imagining a city in which people organically dwell and make meaningful sense and have a theodicy of their relationship to each other and the world. That humanistic imperative is being undermined in an educational enterprise that has sought a strategic partnership with business and capitalism in perverse forms of neoliberalism, with profound consequences for minority groups and minority populations in particular. And education within this logic, as it becomes now a more and more of a target for the mobilization of immaterial value, is going through a profound process of structural reorganization in which the labor process, the process of intellectual labor, and the issues of intellectual autonomy are most profoundly challenged and most profoundly threatened. And I'm using this forum to centrally call attention to this, and I would like to stop there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. And we have a very short time for if there is any questions from anyone in the room. La puc traduir, eh? Si, ui, no, puc intentar traduir-la, més ben dit. Si.
Sí,
és que no veig. Yes. Great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I particularly, I thought that when you talked about the problems, for example, in the north of England, you highlighted those problems very, very well, the problem of the indigenous population, the white population, the resentment caused by the influx of workers, immigrant workers, and the problem of unemployment in those areas. That's a problem which is a very similar problem to one in Catalonia and in many, many other areas. My question is, for me, that raises a big question about education, the resentment question, the anger, the frustration, which was shown in the clip of the film.
Yeah.
The question I have is, how can we deal with the problem of education being complicit with market forces, with advanced capitalism, in the sense that I immediately thought of two issues. The fact that multiculturalism is promoted in schools, in a sense that it tries to deal with the problems for the children and help the children to cope. I'm talking about all children, whether the white children or the immigrant children. How does that stop just being something which is superficial?
Yes.
And also another problem of adult education programs. For example, in the north of England, there are many programs that try to deal with the anger, the stress, anger management programs. And they try to deal with the problem, the symptoms. But to what extent are we simply educating ourselves and our communities to be quiet?
Yeah.
It's kind of there is a question there somewhere.
Yeah. Now, you're quite right, and you ask a very challenging question. My feeling is that education cannot be thought of in separation from larger social policy. And that these must be seen dynamically in relation to each other. Scholars have pointed out in the US context that if you want conditions to change for the poor. And I like to think of this in class and race terms together. It's not acceptable in any society for any group to be chronically unemployed, whether it's white, whether it's black, whatever. It seems to me that the society somehow is impoverished morally by that circumstance. We find it impossible in the United States to have that conversation because there is such a powerful neoconservative element that rides the tensions of ethnicity and direct them away from what is the most important to me conversation. That is, how are we going to create the terms in which people have meaningful jobs, meaningful life existence, and have access to healthcare, education, etc. That is the conversation that is very difficult to reach in our context. So revanchism, resentment is very useful to these groups of people who are invested in political distraction from the major issue. The major issue, in my view, is that we have had, since the 1970s, in the United States and England and elsewhere, a program of what David Harvey would call class redistribution. That is, redistribution of resources from the working class to elites. So if you look at income inequality, or what is called the wealth inequality, you see the people in the top 5% or 1%, incomes just expanding, while the people in the bottom 20-25% are falling. I mean, this is demonstrable, and it follows this logic of the handing over of public resources, etc. It seems to me that conversation has to come into multicultural education. We have somehow proceeded to push it off by simply talking about cultural differences. But I want to ground cultural differences in economic and social circumstances for people, where we begin by respecting all people's conditions, but linking those conditions to the fact that we exist in a real existing conditions of neoliberalism, a particular stage of the development of capitalism. I'm not reducing everything to capitalism, but I'm saying that these developments have to be understood in tandem, in relation to each other. We have to do it in a context that we know we can't solve every problem, but we can have more meaningful conversations towards the goal of developing what I think is most profoundly to our intellectual labor, the goal of reflexive understanding of contemporary life. I think that's fundamentally what we as teachers do, what we as academics do. It's the core of our intellectual labor.
Okay. Any more questions? Yes.
Sí, jo més que fer una pregunta, voldria fer-me una bona volta un parell de reflexions que m'ha suscitat la conversació del professor, que l'he trobat extremadament interessant. En primer lloc, a mi m'ha cridat molt l'atenció i em porta molt a reflexionar tots aquests criteris neocapitalistes que regeixen el sistema educatiu. Jo penso que aquí ens hi trobem del tot. Jo crec, per la meva experiència, jo soc professora d'institut, que els criteris que regeixen el sistema educatiu són uns criteris purament neocapitalistes,
ocults sota una capa de correcció política i de fi, tota una sèrie de preceptes doncs, del tot lloables, però que el que hi ha al darrere és això, neocapitalista, furiós, encarat als resultats. Encarat als resultats i a aquests criteris de mínima inversió, màxim benefici, per dir-ho així.
Maybe it's a technical thing, I think.
Ah, potser ells ho poden traduir, seran més.
Yeah, I couldn't hear it. So I,
no?
Yeah, I couldn't hear the translation. So,
yes, basically, is this not a... T'apaito un segon,
sí,
perquè
sí.
Potser
després... Sí, sí, però és com un nivell d'anglès, vull dir, no és el suficient com per poder-me expressar.
Three, sí, yeah.
Anglès,
I have it at three.
Well, basically, the idea that he's trying to set is that at this moment at the education in Catalonia, I understand that was she's saying there is a clearly neoliberalism in like it's focused on the looking for results in all the kind of education. He's talking about the education in the basic primary education. I understand, and fins aquí, eh?
La segona qüestió és...
És una qüestió,
és una qüestió. I l'altra qüestió, i d'aquí ve derivat, per exemple, és un altre aspecte que m'ha semblat molt interessant de la seva conferència, és aquest detriment, escandalós jo crec, de les humanitats, i aquest retrocés de les humanitats. Per exemple, en el batxillerat actualment tots els estudiants fan 4 hores de ciències del món contemporani, que és evidentíssim, que és una qüestió interessantíssima, indispensable per a la formació, però estan fent 2 hores de llengua i literatura. 2 hores de llengua i literatura. La literatura universal és una matèria que pràcticament ja no s'imparteix en cap institut, perquè com que no hi ha hores per poder-la impartir amb el retallament de plantilles, és que enlloc, pràcticament, o sigui, amb molt pocs, no sé que siguin instituts molt grans, amb una certa dotació de professorat que pugui fer-ho, no que pugui fer-ho perquè pugui impartir la matèria, sinó que hi hagi les hores, es doti dels recursos de les hores, la literatura universal ha desaparegut de la immensa majoria dels instituts d'ensenyament secundari del país. I em sembla una pèrdua gravíssima de cara a tots aquests aspectes.
Did you understand?
Yes, she's just talking
about the decrease of the humanities and the literature on the curriculum of the education. And sorry, but we have to close here. It's over. We have to go now to a small breakfast that's outside in the cluster. I just want to say thank you very much for coming. We expect to see you again here in Girona or in Barbados.
Barbados.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you can come here tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.